It's a pleasure to have today André Grossart giving us the Quantum Foundation seminar. And he's from the University of Vienna in Germany, and he will be talking to us about semi-classical gravity. So I'm very curious to hear about what you have to say, and the stage is yours.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. I have to that like just ahead maybe as a small warning. So this week has been relatively crazy for me privately. My son is a bit sick, so yeah, to stay home from childcare this week. And yeah, so I just finished those slides yesterday evening. I'm giving this talk for the first time. So if I'm just acting surprised about what I'm seeing, then it's just because I am. So I'm actually seeing some of those slides for the first time since I made them. Yeah, so I want to talk about semi-classical gravity, which is the idea that gravity is fundamentally classical or fundamentally non-quantum in some sense. And I want to talk a bit about thought experiments, arguments of consistencies that are usually made, and try to give a bit a different perspective maybe from what people's usual opinion or prejudices are about what is or is not weird about this. So in order to start, the question we are interested in some sense, is actually a very simple one. Just imagine you have a spatial superposition state. As here in the picture, double slit experiment with a particle going through either of the slits or any other type of interferometry setup, something like a Stern-Gerlach interferometer is probably an even more suitable type of setup. But so yeah, you have a massive particle in a superposition state coherently, and you want to know what is the gravitational field of that superposition, or maybe a bit more physically, to phrase the question a bit more like operational physically, if we had a test mass and we wanted to know, okay, we wanted to track the gravitational field by observing the motion of this test mass, what would we expect to find? And of course, you can easily brush this question off because you can say, well, we know what happens in electrodynamics, and this is all just non-relativistic, low energy, Newtonian gravity. Why should anything be different from what we know from electrodynamics? And this is, of course, a fair point. But on the other hand, we know that at some point, something should be different from between electrodynamics and gravity, because otherwise we could just all the way go ahead and quantize gravity exactly like we quantize electrodynamics. So it's still a fair point to ask what happens. And it's particularly interesting because we don't have any experimental data from which we could say what should happen in the situation. All we can do is draw analogies from theory to other situations that we know, to electrodynamics, to other quantum field theories, and so on. So I'm doing this a bit different today in the talk than I usually do it. Usually I'm talking about all the arguments for or against semi-classical gravity. Since this is kind of the main topic of the talk today, I want to start and just introduce what is usually considered when people say semi-classical gravity, or you could also call it mean field semi-classical gravity to make it a bit more distinctive, which is the idea that dates back to Möller and Rosenfeld to say, well, if we want to keep space-time fundamentally classical, what we should do is we should, in Einstein's equations, just replace the right-hand side, the stress-energy tensor that usually describes classical matter. We need to replace that by something that corresponds to our quantum matter. And the easiest way to do this is to take the expectation value of the stress-energy operator. Then you get the semi-classical Einstein equations, which are often seen as just the mean field limit of some quantum theory of gravity, and then, for example, used to calculate things like Hawking radiation. But the idea here is that we treat this as a fundamental equation. So let's just assume gravity works this way, that fundamentally we have Einstein's equations, we have a classical space-time, And we have the right-hand side of Einstein's equations given by the expectation value. If you do this, then, and you take the non-relativistic limit of this theory, like you usually do in general relativity, so like you get the Newtonian limit, you get the Newtonian gravitational potential, which in classical GR would basically just be sourced by the mass density at the non-relativistic limit. And now it is sourced essentially by the expectation value of the mass density operator. And if you then look at the level of the Schrödinger equation, you find what is usually referred to as the Schrödinger-Newton equation. So it's a non-linear Schrödinger equation. The gravitational potential that comes up in this Schrödinger equation, fundamental Schrödinger equation for a single particle, has a non-linear potential that is basically the Newtonian gravitational potential that acts as if the probability density, the wave function, absolute value squared of the wave function, acts like a mass density. And so this results in some gravitational self-interaction of the wave function. So the particle, if you think of you can think of a particle that basically sees its own wave function as if it was a mass density that is interacting with it gravitationally. So if you think, for example, of a Gaussian state, like you have some Gaussian that in standard quantum mechanics would just spread, then you have these self-gravitational effects that will make it spread a bit slower first. And if you increase the mass, eventually you will get a behavior that is even that it's either stationary or even somehow collapsing to something that's a solitonic state at some point. So this Schrödinger-Newton equation has been studied quite a lot by myself and others in order to basically figure out, okay, if this were true, could we test this experimentally? And the first thing that has been looked at is kind of the obvious thing, to look at the free spreading of such a wave function, for example, a free Gaussian. The masses you need are not really that ridiculously far away from what can be done in interferometry experiments. But what's very challenging is the coherence times that you would need, which are usually of the order of minutes or even hours. And then there have been suggestions to test this equation in optomechanical systems, where you basically get effects also from this nonlinearity. This has effects on the spectrum of an harmonic oscillator, which then becomes dependent on the shape of the wave function. So you don't have equidistant energy levels anymore in an harmonic oscillator. Or you can look at squeezed states, for example, squeezed Gaussian states, which will oscillate, where the internal oscillation of your wave function will then be slightly off from the oscillation of the center of your wave function. So those are effects you can look for in order to verify or falsify this equation. And there has been recently a different proposal that got quite a lot of attention, actually two independent papers, one by Zugatte Bose and collaborators, and then Maletto and Vedral had similar ideas, to test whether or not gravity is quantized by looking for whether the gravitational interaction between two masses results in entanglement of those two masses. I don't want to go into the details of that. I'm not sure you might have heard talks about that already. But the idea is to look for entanglement through gravity here. This is what we had basically about semi-classical gravity. So there is the idea, okay, somehow maybe gravity is not quantized. Can we test for that? Yeah, we can test for this Schrödinger-Newton equation. We can test for entanglement and somehow expect that quantized gravity would give entanglement and non-quantized gravity would not give us entanglement. But there isn't really a systematic a systematic idea of what does it mean for gravity to be quantized, or what does it mean for gravity to be semi-classical. One thing that has been done relatively early in 1981, there was actually an experiment done. I'm not sure if it really deserves the name experiment, because the experimental part of it was relatively simple. It's actually more like a student lab experiment by Page and Geiker, who basically did an experiment that is just, you take some quantum decision making process, you measure, in their case they had some cesium atoms, I think, and they measured whether the number of events they counted in a certain time interval was above or below the average number that you would expect. And so you get a yes-no answer from some quantum measurement, and then you use the result of this yes-no measurement in order to move a macroscopic mass, a large mass, into one of two positions and measure the gravitational field. The point of this is that they say, well, if we assume that quantum mechanics is true all the way up, then if we have a massive superposition, sure, we have decoherence, but actually, so if we look at the density matrix for such a massive state, we will start with a quantum state that has interference terms. It will decohere into a diagonal density matrix. But if we calculate now the expectation value of the stress energy operator, which basically is just the mass density operator in the non-relativistic limit, we find that the mass density, the mass distribution we get from this that enters on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations in mean field semi-classical gravity, that this mass density is the same regardless of whether the state has already decohered or not. So basically they were saying, well, I don't have to care about decoherence then. I just do this experiment in a setting where I take the measurement result and then by hand set the mass into another state. And obviously, as expected, you do not observe that there is any gravitation towards the center of this mass distribution, right? So you would expect from semi-classical gravity, if you have positions left and right, that the gravitational field would be somewhere in the middle. And this is, of course, not what you observe. So the way that was presented by Page and Geiker was basically as evidence that gravity must be quantized. I would see it as much weaker, but what you can learn from this is that whatever the state does, whatever the wave function does, the density matrix is in this sense, so that this diagonal density matrix must actually correspond as you learn it when you start learning about quantum statistics. That this rho t, the density matrix at the time t, corresponds to a mixture of two classical collapsed states, which then individually would enter the Einstein's equations with their expectation value, and not that the whole density matrix enters. So in this sense, you could say that if you want to have a consistent mean field semi-classical theory of gravity, you need some sort of collapse process. So you it's not enough to just talk about the density matrix. You need to actually talk about the wave function, and you need to talk about the collapse of the wave function during measurement. And the difficulty, and this is kind of, even though it's a not as obvious in the paper, this is kind of the main argument of Page and Geiker, is that such a collapse process, in order to lead to something as a right-hand side of Einstein's equations that is consistent with general relativity, it must obey the conversation of the covariant derivative, so that if I act with the, or if I trace with the covariant derivative over the Einstein tensor, I get zero. And the same must be true for whatever the right-hand side of Einstein's equations is. And this is for what you usually have in mind when you think about collapse of the wave function, instantaneous, non-local collapse, this is not true for such a collapse. So in some sense, this is kind of the big question: is there some dynamical description of collapse? That is consistent with this conservation law. And so this brings us then with this result, we can come to basically to answer the question: okay, what do we need? What is semi-classical gravity? What do we mean by semi-classical gravity? What are the ingredients that we need? And if you want to break it down to something quite general, then what you need, classifies semi-classical gravity is that you have a classical spacetime. So we have, as in GR, we have a pseudo-Riemannian full manifold on which our matter fields live. We have quantum fields of matter. In the simplest case, we assume we have the standard model field. So we have quantum field theory on curved spacetime, essentially. There are a lot of open questions in this field, but in principle, we know that we can describe quantum fields on curved spacetime consistently. So this is fine. We could have additional further degrees of freedom, hidden variables, so anything that helps us either explain gravity or explain the wave function collapse may or may not appear in this theory in addition. So we just leave this open as a possibility. But the main point is that what we need in order to have a full consistent theory, we need to say what is the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. So what sources space-time curvature? This can be the expectation value of T mu nu, but it could be something different. We need, and this is the part of the previous slide, we also need some description of the measurement process. So we need to understand what happens in a measurement in some sort of dynamical way or some way that is somehow in part of our theory and consistent with our theory. And then if we have hidden variables, we want to have some dynamical laws that describe these variables, obviously. So the first thing to note is that we do not have a full relativistic theory of semi-classical gravity yet. So that is the first thing you can point out. So whenever I talk about semi-classical gravity, I talk about something that is unfinished. You should keep in mind, however, that we do not have a full theory of quantum gravity either. So from that respect, there is nothing better or worse about semi-classical gravity than quantum gravity. It's just puzzling in different areas in some sense. So the questions that need to be addressed are different ones. But from that perspective, you can say there is nothing that is actually a full theory that satisfies all those conditions. You also should notice at this point that something being quantum in this sense would mean that it's not semi-classical gravity, so that it does not have a classical spacetime. And this does not necessarily mean that it has perturbative quantum gravity as its low energy limit. So neither is it such that all theories need to be either semi-classical or perturbative or lead to perturbative quantum gravity. And it could even be, although I don't really have an idea of what such a theory could look like, but you could even think of in principle that you have a semi-classical theory that would give you perturbative quantum gravity as a limit. All of that would be consistent with this type of definition of semi-classical gravity. The important thing is that you have a classical pseudo-Riemannian full manifold as space-time and quantum fields on that space-time. So after having this set up and having basically defined what we are talking about, if we say semi-classical gravity, we can start looking at several arguments that have been made in the past that are arguing why or why not, or yeah, that gravity should be quantized, and what is supposed to be wrong with a semi-classical approach that couples quantum matter to a classical space-time. And the first one There are actually two thought experiments that I want to discuss. Are two consistency arguments essentially true that are based on the idea of that you can use classical gravity to get which way information of a quantum system. So this goes back to Epley and Hanna already in 1977. They proposed this as an argument why gravity must be quantized. And the idea is basically if you have a classical gravitational wave that gives you which way information about a particle if it's scattered, so it collapses the particle, then you can start with a particle with a very well-defined momentum and scatter a gravitational wave at it to determine its position. And since a classical gravitational wave is not bound by the de Broglie relation, so it can have both short wavelength and small momentum at the same time, you can use this to violate the uncertainty principle. And then Epley and Hanna propose a concrete experiment how they would do that. So this argument has already been criticized in the past by Albers and others, for example, who point out that the uncertainty relation is only a corollary in quantum mechanics. So there is no need that such a theory that would modify quantum theory must obey the uncertainty principle in all regimes. And the second criticism comes from Mattingly, who actually pointed out that the concrete experimental proposal that Epley and Hanna had in their paper is infeasible, not just in practice, but also in principle, because, for example, with the numbers they give, their detector would be sitting inside a black hole. Also, and this is kind of an important point, if you just look at mean field semi-classical gravity, as I mentioned before, you have the additional problem that this theory does not even allow you to gain any which way information. There, the gravitational field just depends on the total wave function. So in any state, in any superposition state, you end up with the same gravitational field regardless of the quantum state of your particle. Can I just quickly have some feedback if you're hearing me fine? Because I have the feeling that the picture freezes from time to time. Okay. So you can actually combine these arguments made by Mattingly and Albers and others, and together with the description that Epley and Hanna themselves give of their experiment. So what you can do is you can generate a gravitational wave. So that's what they do. That's the experiment that they describe. You generate a gravitational wave by colliding two objects with a size of the wavelength that you want to achieve and with some energy E. And then your massive particle for which you want to violate the uncertainty principle is sitting at the distance small r, and you can calculate the energy of the wave that is being scattered off, which is E squared m squared divided by lambda r squared. And now the detectors they are proposing are oscillators of some mass capital M and some length scale capital L, which are again at a distance capital R from the mass with small m. So now you can calculate with which energy those oscillators will oscillate when the scattered gravitational wave hits them. And now you require that for a transition. So you want to have a transition of these oscillators with probability one. In order to have this, you need a certain number of oscillators that is given by the energy omega zero of a single oscillator divided by this energy that you get from the scattered particle. So this leads to a total mass that you need to have of all n detectors, which is n times capital M, which you can calculate then to be this expression, omega zero lambda squared r squared, small r squared divided by m squared l squared e squared. And now you can use, first of all, that the wavelength lambda must be, must be larger than, must be larger than the length L of the oscillators. And you can use that the particle should not sit in a black hole in the first place. So R must be larger than M. All of this is in units with G, C, H bar set to unity. So you end up with a total mass that must be at least omega zero R squared divided by M squared. And now Mattingly makes the argument, well, if you want to actually detect this single oscillator with the energy E oscillation divided by omega zero, you need to require that the temperature at which you have your oscillators is smaller than the frequency of these oscillators. Otherwise, the thermal fluctuations would just overpower what you can measure. And Mattingly just calculates some theory that some temperature that is ridiculously small and says, well, we don't really know how we can achieve such a temperature. But you can actually do better than that. You can just look at the temperature that you will unavoidably have, namely at the surface, at the equipotential surface of radius r. You will have to can look at the gravitational field there, and you have the Hawking effect, the Unruh effect, that gives you a Hawking temperature at this radius, which is the total mass. So the mass of the particle, it's a rough order of estimate, of course. The mass of your particle plus the total mass of all the detectors, all of this must sit in this radius capital R. So this is the temperature that you have at the surface at this radius, roughly, just from Hawking radiation. And now you can check what this means. So the total mass must be larger than omega zero r squared divided by m squared, but omega must be larger than t. So this leads to this relation, m total must be larger than small m plus m total divided by small m squared. And now you can look at both cases where capital M is larger than small m or small m is larger than capital M. And in both cases, you find that small m must be larger than one. Or to summarize, what you find is that in order to actually violate the uncertainty principle, the least you need, even if everything else would be a perfect experiment, the least you need is you need at least a Planck mass for your particle. Now, a Planck mass is not super high, of course. It's 10 to the minus 8 kilograms, so not something that's completely ridiculous. But to the best of my knowledge, we haven't even done any quantum experiments that would have confirmed the uncertainty principle for masses of this of this range. So even without giving any other constraints on that the numbers you measured were just too small compared to what you would expect as a violation of the uncertainty principle, you cannot violate it, not even in principle, for those masses for which we currently do quantum experiments. The second paradox that has been discussed is a bit more interesting. It's the idea to use which way information for faster than light signaling. And this has originally been proposed by Murray and others, and Belenkian and others then in 2018 have proposed a solution, or have basically shown how quantized gravity avoids this paradox. So the idea is you have Alice and Bob. Alice has some particle in a superposition state for which Alice can make an interference experiment. Bob, just in the simplest case, just has a small test mass, which will feel the gravitational field of Alice's mass. And depending on Alice's state, Bob's mass would end up in slightly different positions with this position shift delta x. So this is just a figure from the Belenkian paper. So now the question is, can Bob actually signal faster than light? So can Bob signal in a time that is smaller than the distance between Alice and Bob? By gaining which way information about Alice's particle and thereby decohering Alice's state, so that Alice, by doing her interference experiment, can see, okay, I find interference, so Bob did measure, or I did not find interference, so Bob did not measure. So the first observation you make is that if you have quantized gravitational fields, you have quantum fluctuations of the curvature tensor. And this means that any resolution in space that you can hope for measuring must be at least of the order of the Planck length. You can't measure anything more accurate than the Planck length. So this is the argument by Belenkia and al. And others. However, you can make this argument purely classical. You can just say, well, in order to measure the position of Bob's particle, I need to scatter some quantum particle at it. So and scattering this quantum particle, you need to scatter it on with a scattering ratio, with a scattering radius of at least the Schwarzschild radius of your mass. Because otherwise it would just fall into a black hole given defined by your mass. And those two criteria by themselves already mean that you cannot measure more accurately the position of your particle than the Planck length. You don't need to talk about quantization of gravity at all for this. You just need to assume that you have the Schwarzschild radius from gravity, and you have quantum uncertainty for a particle that you scatter in order to measure the position, for example, a photon that you use to seeing the position of your particle. So this criterion you get regardless of whether gravity is classical or quantized, and it leads to, in order to signal faster than light, you find, so now you can look at different situations depending on which effect determines the Newtonian gravitational field. So you can first say, well, the dipole moment of the mass distribution here is what determines my field. So then you have the dipole moment here must be larger than the distance. Belenkia and others point out that if you actually account for center of mass conservation, so if you create the superposition, you also create the superposition of your lab because the center of mass is conserved, then what should matter is the quadrupole moment. And it was then later pointed out that it's actually not even the quadrupole moment, it's actually the octupole moment for the symmetric situation they are considering, because the quadrupole moment will just be the same regardless of the particle being left or right. But regardless which moment you have either the dipole moment being larger than d, or the quadrupole moment larger than d squared, or octupole larger than d cubed. So this is the condition how strong your gravitational field needs to be in order to signal faster than light, in order to detect the shift in Bob's particle in a time shorter than this distance d. And now you can look on Alice's side and can ask, okay, what does it actually take for Alice to make this interference experiment? And you find that Alice, obviously, when Alice closes her dipole again to make the interference experiment, she will emit gravitational waves. And now you can either say she emits gravitons if gravity is quantized, and you want her to not be able to emit a single graviton because this would give away which way information. Or again, you can make the same argument classically. You can say, well, she will emit classical gravitational waves. And in order to not give away which way information, you need the energy that is radiated off to be smaller than 1 divided by t, 1 divided by the time that you have, because then according to the, if you are below that, you're below the threshold of the time energy uncertainty, where you cannot detect this information. Yeah, so this again leads to a criterion where the nth moment must be now smaller than d to the power n. So you see that both of those cannot simultaneously be realized. So there is no way to signal faster than light. So the point is there is no need for quantization in this argument. You can make this argument perfectly well with classical gravitational waves and classical gravitational field. All you need is the limitation to the Planck length, which also appears in the classical situation. I see a hand. I don't hear.
Sorry. I don't know. Do you want me to ask it at the end or?
No. Just go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So maybe. Let me make something a bit more precise. So the octuple argument actually is in the paper.
We are
perfectly well aware that in the symmetric configuration there is an octuple that is the one that matters. It's just that the discussion that we have is more general and the octuple only counts in a very specific configuration. And while unless you are in the really symmetric configuration, it's the quadruple that matters. While in the electromagnetic case, it is in general the dipole, and in a symmetric configuration, it's the quadruple.
Yes.
And then I didn't really understand because we also know that it is not necessary to quantize the gravitational field. If you make this argument that any model that like Carolyazi model or the coherence model would perfectly well explain the protocol, like it would not lead to violations of faster than light signaling. So I didn't understand if you are saying this or you're saying something more.
I just think so. So what I'm referring to is that I think the paper has been misunderstood in this way by several people. So I've heard the argument multiple times. I'm not saying that that's in the paper. I'm just saying I've heard the argument that this would show now that you need to quantize the gravitational field. That there was, for example, a paper on the archive. A month ago or two, I think that was basically. Trying to also show that your argument does not show the quantization of gravity and that it can be explained by classical.
I agree with you that it does not imply that the gravitational field should be quantized. Yeah. It is an explanation. Like if you quantize the gravitational field, then you do not have faster than light signal.
Exactly.
But you will need some mechanism that is either decoherence or something like that to prevent it otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. So the point, my point is just to say, okay, so you presented an argument how this paradox can be resolved by quantized gravity. What I'm saying is you can make actually exactly the same argument and not even talk about quantized degrees of the gravitational field at all. You can just talk about classical gravity and you can give good arguments there. They aren't maybe as tight as when you really talk about quantized gravity. Then it's a bit more difficult to use things like the energy time uncertainty relation, right? But in principle, you can give reasonable arguments why also there is a mechanism even just from classical gravity that would prevent superluminal signaling in this situation. Is that something you could agree with or
so I'm not sure that you could stick to just classical gravity. You would need something more than just that.
Well, you need quantum matter on top of it, right? So you need the properties of the quantum matter in addition to the classical gravity. But on the gravity side, I don't think you need any sort of you need any sort of.
Okay, maybe we can discuss this offline.
Yeah, maybe that's yeah. Actually, how am I doing with time? Because I don't see my time here.
So you have roughly 20 minutes.
Right. Yeah, that should be fine. Okay, I just continue. We discuss afterwards. So that's that argument. So just to reiterate quickly, so the main point is that, yeah, these arguments are both based on Rich Bay information anyways. So if you look at mean field semi-classical gravity, none of this applies because there simply is no Rich Bay information from the gravitational field. What is taken a lot more seriously, rightfully, is the argument again also against mean field semi-classical gravity, that if you have something like the Schrödinger-Newton equation, if you have a nonlinear Schrödinger equation or any nonlinear evolution law for the states, you have the problem that you can get faster than light signaling. So the argument is pretty simple. You can, for example, in the simplest case, you can just think of a set of two entangled spin 1/2 particles. You bring them in a superposition state. You send them to through two Stern-Gerlach interferometers, and now Alice say can make a decision. Bob makes a decision here. Bob can make the decision to measure either in the X or in the Z basis. Of course, in the standard description of quantum mechanics, you would then calculate Alice's reduced density matrix by tracing over Bob's state, and you find the same density matrix regardless of whether or not, or regardless of the basis in which Bob makes his measurement. So what you have is our equivalent mixtures here. So in standard linear quantum mechanics, the measurements made by Alice are, of course, independent on any choice of basis by Bob. And the crucial property is of course, that such equivalent mixtures in a linear theory remain equivalent mixtures. And now in semi-classical gravity, you can instead, so if you just have this very same experiment, you have in the first situation where Bob measures in the spin set basis, and Alice now also does a Stern-Gerlach experiment in the set basis, then Alice will end up with either a state where the particle takes the upper path or it takes the lower path. However, if you have one of the spin X eigenstates for Bob, then Alice will have a superposition state. So Alice's state will actually feel this self-gravitational interaction. So because the whole wave function gravitates, the whole wave function is what generates the gravitational field. The superposition state, the plus state, will correspond to a gravitational field where half the mass is in the top and half the mass is in the bottom position. So regardless on which state we are in, the particle always feels a gravitational pull towards the center. So there is actually a change of the position state of the particle, so indicated here by this Z tilde instead of Z, which differs from the original positions from the positions for without gravity, by basically the Newtonian gravitational interaction between those two particles. So you have a different situation in semi-classical gravity. The measurement outcomes for Alice now actually depend on the choice of basis by Bob. So Bob can send a signal basically through his choice of basis. And this can in principle happen over arbitrarily large distances. So this is, of course, a problem. However, what you have to keep in mind is that this argument that dates back to Gizan originally requires, in some sense, the projection postulate. So Bob's measurement actually projects on one of the spin eigenstates. And instead, we already noticed that we don't really want to we need to include the collapse somehow in our model of semi-classical gravity if we want it to be consistent. We have already figured that out as the result from the Page and Geiger experiment. We also know that in order to be compatible with general relativity, we need some collapse law that would be compatible with the with the four divergence freedom of general relativity. So it can't be an instantaneous collapse. It can't just be a projection. We also, obviously, we don't know what this collapse is, what it could look like. But let us just take some sort of prototype model that is based on the criterion that was given by Penrose, namely that there should be a wave function collapse that is somehow associated, that has a rate that is associated with the gravitational self energy. And in addition, we do what also happens in the Dursley model, for example. We assume that there is some parameter, some length scale, which we call RC. And this collapse model, for some reason, so we only are interested in the case where we have basically a point like, so a superposition of two delta functions. We don't talk about any type of different state. We're not interested in Gaussian states, for example, at the moment. We just want to know when does such a macroscopic superposition, such a gravitational cat state, when does this decohere? And we say, well, as a rule, we say whenever the size of the superposition becomes larger than its critical radius RC, then the wave function will collapse with a rate that is proportional to the gravitational self energy, so to m squared divided by RC. This is a condition that is roughly compatible with what you have in the Dursley-Penrose model, but I'm personally not a big fan of this model, so I didn't want to make it more specific than it needs to be. So we just have something that could potentially work this way, just for the fun. And now, so we can then calculate what is the shift in set based on the gravitational interactions. So we assume that the difference, the delta set, the large capital delta set, is the size of our superposition. This should be much larger than the tiny shift that we get from gravity, which is mt squared divided by delta z squared. And we get a limit on this shift delta z from the uncertainty principle. This is essentially the standard quantum limit. So basically we have momentum uncertainty initially, which leads to a final position uncertainty plus the initial uncertainty in position, which leads to an absolute limit, which is delta z. For convenience, so that I don't have square roots, I put delta z to the fourth here, which must be larger than t squared divided by m squared. And so this I can now, use my criterion that the shift is delta z is mt squared divided by delta z squared. I can use that instead of t. And then I find in total, if I put all of this together, I find as a criterion that the mass cubed must be larger than capital delta z squared divided by small delta z cubed, which is much larger than 1 divided by delta z. So this is of course not a problem. We can always just make the mass large enough, so we can always satisfy this for whatever uncertainty we have given in our experiment, whatever position resolution we have given. We just choose a large enough mass, and we will eventually be able to do this. However, we have to now take into account also our prototype collapse model. So we have to achieve this shift delta z. In a time that must be shorter than the collapse time given by this collapse description. So this means, RC is m squared times the collapse time. So this must be larger than m squared times the time. And again, if you use for the time, the equation that follows from Newtonian dynamics, we find that this RC must be larger than delta z squared divided by delta z. Or much larger than the small delta set. If I combine the two, I find that as the first result, I find that this collapse radius must be much larger than 1 over m cubed in order to be able to to get this to have a resolution at all that would allow me to detect this this difference before this gravitational collapse mechanism kicks in. So now we can plot this criterion. That's this black line where we have 1 divided by m cubed equals rc. So basically, just everything on the right top right of this line would be a parameter range. So what we have plotted here is rc over the mass. So only everything that's on top of this line would be parameters. Parameter combinations of RC and the mass that would allow for a detection of the self-gravitational effect in this concrete experiment, and therefore for faster than light signaling. But we have to, in addition, we have to also account if we have a superposition size that is smaller than the radius of our particle, then the gravitational interaction is not the point interaction with the Coulomb potential anymore, but it's one that depends on the mass density of a particle. So I can make exactly the same argument, can go through the same calculation, and I find a criterion that is RC to the 9th mass density to the 4th must be larger than the mass to the power 13. So this line you can also plot, that's the blue line here. For the mass of osmium, but for the mass density of osmium, but it doesn't really matter much as long as you take some realistic material, there will be a line roughly around where the blue line is. And so you need to basically, now you need to look at this purple line, which is where RC equals the particle radius. So basically, if you're on top of the purple line, you need to be, excuse me, I'm confused by myself, by my own plot now. If you're above the purple line, then this criterion that's given by the black line is the determining criterion. If you were below the purple line, then technically the blue line is what determines where you need to be, but you see that you basically already have a stricter criterion from the blue line than you would have from just the purple line. So what you end up is that basically only parameters in this green regime here would allow for faster than light signaling. So now you can ask, well, what is experimentally excluded? Those are all those red dots. And basically, so any sort of collapse description, whatever it could be, as long as it is something that effectively can be described in this way that we described it, with some parameter RC that falls in between these red dots and this green shaded area, would not allow faster than light signaling. Despite being completely compatible with all experiments that have been done so far. So the conclusion from that is that even people sometimes claim so you hear that a lot, that people say, well, gravity might not be quantized, but we clearly know that the mean field semiclassical approach is not the right one because it leads to this faster than light signaling. Mean field semi-classical gravity may not be dead yet, at least. So the crucial question is the one, what can such a collapse model be, can such a collapse be found? If you take mean field semi-classical gravity, it's important to notice that a direct test of the Schrödinger-Newton equation of the self-gravitational effect would be just as telling as finding this entanglement, or rather not finding this entanglement in these Bose-Mallet-Vergeil experiments. It's only if you have different ideas of what semi-classical gravity can be, where you might have scenarios where those experiments are actually better than just directly testing the Schrödinger-Newton equation. So then the question is, of course, with regard to mean field semi-classical gravity, are there any other ways to couple couple quantum matter? So what I already said, the crucial question is, well, what we do not have is the theory of measurement that would be compatible with this type of semi-classical gravity. So the question is there any such description, or is that the thing where it ultimately fails and where we need to look for something else and maybe need to quantize gravity after all? So in this regard, it's interesting to see that semi-classical gravity itself may play a role in this, right? So what it gives you for free is the non-linearity that you need to explain measurement. The open questions are then, is there any way to account for the stochasticity that you have, the Born rule, when you make measurements? So this is not naturally included in any way in the semi-classical theory, but you could think of it being just emergent, like it is usually the case in stochastic mechanics, that it just depends on the initial.
Okay. You're back. you're muted now.
Sorry. So this was the announced problems with my Wi-Fi. So now I need to share the screen again. I should also come to an end, I see. Let me just try to go through this very quickly. Okay, so the question is stochasticity, can we include the Born rule in this? What do we deal with non-locality? Just very briefly, I don't go into the details now. So there, if you think of what other ideas could one have for semi-classical gravity? There is, in principle, this option. One could have a hidden variable theory. So if you think of Bohmian mechanics, there you have the particle coordinates. So you can just use the particle coordinates to source a Newtonian gravitational field. This is, in principle, a charming idea. And the funny thing is that something like that would actually make exactly the same predictions as quantized gravity, but does have a semi-classical interpretation in the sense that you say there is a classical space-time and curvature is sourced by these Bohmian particle coordinates. The problem, of course, as usually in Bohmian mechanics, is the question whether there is a relativistic version of this. So if you do this in the simple way and say you have classical fields instead of the particle coordinates, then you do not get a consistent theory. And very briefly, so there have been actually two proposals in the more or less recent past that are stochastic semi-classical theories that try to avoid these conflicts with standard quantum mechanics, in particular this Fassel and light signaling issue right from the beginning by defining semi-classical gravity in a way that is more more in the spirit of quantum mechanics somehow. So the one is the model by Tilloy and Yoshi, which basically uses collapse models to source gravity. So there you take the signal that you just get as the outcome of weak measurements of the mass density and plug this back in, so feed this back into your Schrödinger equation as sourcing a Newtonian gravitational potential. So this is nice. It requires collapse models to be true, of course. So you need to have collapse models first somehow, and this is a natural way then in which you would expect semi-classical gravity to appear. And again, the problem is what is a relativistic generalization of this. So this is only a Newtonian theory. And then there's the other idea, which is the idea of having hybrid classical quantum theories that are based on ensemble descriptions. So this has been already proposed in 2008 by Albers and others for for scalar gravity, but Oppenheim recently made a theory that is in some sense full GR. So it's based on the ADM formalism, where you talk about three metrics as the classical states, but you have only an ensemble description of those. So you're kind of describing not a classical spacetimes, but an ensemble of classical spacetimes that somehow interacts with quantum states. So there seems to be, to me, I can't really say that I have understood this very well. There seems to be still some problem with individual measurements. So the question, what is the individual space-time in a single measurement? And then it's also a bit unclear to me whether, since the full equations of motion there are still nonlinear, is there really no problem with faster than light signaling? And it looks a bit to me sometimes like it's just mean field semi-classical gravity plus some sort of collapse models on top of it in disguise somehow. So I think it's interesting to look at whether this is really a different theory or whether this is just a different way of describing semi-classical gravity. Yeah, so finally, sort of a conclusion. What I want you to take away from this talk, so my perspective of the whole issue of semi-classical gravity is that the skepticism of about semi-classical gravity may very well be justified. But I think the arguments that are usually made why semi-classical gravity doesn't work are not the crucial ones. So these alleged or real paradoxes. But the main difficulty is, or the main problem is the difficulty to incorporate measurement, to incorporate wave function collapse in such a semi-classical, model. And the interesting thing is that this has actually little to do with gravity as a theory. It's in fact, it looks a lot like it's basically the same issues that trouble other approaches like collapse models or Bohmian mechanics, or attempts to describe quantum mechanics as an emergent theory in other situations. So the problem seems to be more the conflict between quantum non-locality and Lorentz covariance rather than anything specific about gravity. Yes, so with this, I'm at the end. And thank you for your patience. Sorry that I took a bit longer than planned.
Thank you very much for the talk. We can take some questions now. You can raise your hand with the Zoom. So Flaminia.
Okay. Thanks, Philippe. Thanks for the nice talk. So I have a question about the notion of composition in gravitational decoherence. So in these nonlinear models. So because if you have the Schrödinger-Newton equation, then and you have a nonlinear model, then if you want to check whether this violates, for instance, faster than light signaling, then you need to consider at least two parties. And I would expect that under such nonlinearities, the notion of scalar product, of tensor product, all this stuff would have to be modified. Has this been done has this been considered?
That's a good question. Yeah. So the question is basically what is the correct two particle semi-classical theory in some sense, right? Or like basically if you have more than one particle. So the Schrödinger-Newton equation works perfectly fine, of course, as a single particle equation. I think you're right that there are conceptual issues. So you can write a many particle Schrödinger-Newton equation. This has been done by Dioscia already in 1984. And in some sense, this comes out in the same way as you can derive the Schrödinger-Newton equation as a nonlinear. As a non-relativistic limit. So you just need to assume that the different particle sectors do not mix. So you get a many particle Schrödinger-Newton equation. But if you talk about these entangled states, right, you're always talking about you need some additional degree of freedom, which you're actually using to create your superposition, usually spin. So you usually have a system that's not just a spatial wave function or a spatial wave function of two particles, but it's a spatial wave function and two spins. And in particular, this coupling between spin and gravity in semi-classical gravity is not really understood at all. So there are some attempts in this direction to basically derive this also from Klein-Gordon fields on a classical space-time. There's a Dirac fields where you have spin and look at the dynamics of Dirac fields on a curved space-time with self-gravity. But I don't know of any real results that would be in some sense consistent. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
We have another question from Adrian.
Thanks. First, thank you very much. That was a very interesting and very clear talk. I enjoyed it a lot. There's a line of thought you didn't mention, which I guess I've been pursuing for quite a while. So I wonder if you have any reaction to it. I put some papers in the chat that are relevant, but let me summarize the basic idea, which is very simple. The line of thought is, firstly, collapse is an objective process. So that's aligned with your thoughts about semi-classical gravity. Second, it's a localized objective process. So when collapses happen, they happen somewhere, at least in some small region in space-time. So I think that's also aligned with your thought, your discussion. And then the third thing, which obviously is non-standard, but is not evidently inconsistent, is that the effects of collapse, for instance, on the semi-classical gravitational field, propagate only in the future light cone. So that for instance, gives a very simple, another simple reason as to why the Epley-Hanna argument doesn't hold up. It avoids at least it appears to avoid the problems that you mentioned with G-Sound's argument about nonlinearity and superluminality. It's not at all evident that it gives you a relativistic theory. The fact that collapses propagate in the future light cone is consistent with relativity, but it doesn't allow you to define a relativistic theory. So it doesn't solve the problems you have highlighted at the end. But I wonder what you thought about the line of thought as a whole and whether you have any comments.
I know your papers about that and I like them very much. And I agree with you. I think that's a very correct idea. So I don't really have much more to say to that. I didn't mention it in a talk in a way because the line of thought from which I'm coming is slightly different, right? Yes. I was already over time, but no. So I know your papers, and I agree with you basically, and on this result. I would be very interested to discuss that further if you have any interest. But I don't really have much more to comment on that other than yes, I agree with you completely.
I would love to discuss further. So let's see that offline. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? Yes, Tom.
Thanks. Yeah, I had a question. So, yes, I agree with you. So you had, you know, the like criticism of the Gizan argument. They assume the projection postulate, and you know, we have reasons why we might not want to do that. If we modify quantum theory with nonlinearities, we might also modify the projection postulate, for instance. And then you presented an argument where you had, you know, you kind of, as Mott understood, you had this change, but you could still get faster than light signaling. I was wondering, maybe something would be interesting. Could you have a modified modification to the projection postulate where you don't get faster than light signaling? Like maybe a trivial example, which isn't that interesting, is that whatever measurement Bob does, it always collapses as assisting to the same state, like some, you know, some arbitrary state, for instance. then there'd be no faster than light signaling. It probably wouldn't be very physically motivated. So I was wondering if you'd kind of, would it be possible to do this, or is the kind of suggestion you gave kind of, you know, the only one that's consistent with the Newtonian Schrödinger-Newton equation?
No, I don't think it's the only one. I'm not sure if I really understood the reasoning. I would be very interested in discussing, but I have to admit I haven't fully grasped what that.
So I guess my question was, I'll try, and if not, I'll just send it.
So you're referring to, maybe that's easier. I'm generally bad with making things up on the scratch. So you were referring to the argument in the end, right? This Schengeler type experiment. So the argument I'm making is simply in brief, right? It is, if you have a collapse, and that happens as Penrose imagines, that the collapse happens basically at a rate that is somehow related to gravity, you might just end up in a situation where the collapse is always faster than you have the chance to track this self-gravitational effect. That is sort of a hand-waving argument to try to put something a bit more concrete behind this idea. But I'm not claiming in any way that this is the only way to do that. I'm not even claiming that this is a foolproof argument. This is very hand-wavy estimations, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if something is wrong in this argument. I just think it's something you should keep in mind before way too quickly saying, yeah, but it allows faster than light signaling, so it can't possibly be right.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I fully agree.
On the other thing, maybe write me an email. That's probably easier to discuss that.
Yeah. See, I think, I agree. And actually, I realize, you're saying this is just a specific example. And I guess my point was just, we could come up maybe some other, you know, forms of collapse, which maybe no faster than light signaling. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Now I see. Yeah.
Yeah, we have a question by Zach.
Hey, sorry if my internet's terrible, if you can hear me. I had just a comment, which is, I guess, another way that you can get around the Epley-Hammer arguments and the arguments you presented at the beginning, which is if you add some sort of noise between the classical and the quantum coupling. So this is, I think, how the hybrid theories get around the arguments. And I think the basic idea is that if you look at the gravitational field and you know, but there's some noise in the coupling, then you can't necessarily gain which way information, but you can still preserve coherence. I guess related to this, I think that, so with the hybrid theories, the sort of general idea is that you just have some classical noise, but I'm not sure that, I think you mentioned there was problems with measurements because you have ensembles. And I think there maybe isn't such problems. What you have is just, you know, you have some state at some time, and at the next time you don't know what the state will be, but the classical trajectory that you see is objective. And then you just perform standard quantum measurements on the quantum system.
Thank you for your comment. I don't really, as I said, I don't really understand those theories well enough. I am very interested in learning more about that. But just from the impression I have so far is that there are a lot of aspects that somehow remind me of mean field semi-classical gravity plus collapse in some sense, or it's something. I mean, I'm very prejudiced in this, because this is kind of what I have in mind, what somehow should be the thing, right? So my idea is somehow, maybe you can save semi-classical gravity by also having this collapse that is explained by gravity itself. in a way where you basically, we have the coherence effects, so you have the nonlinearity from semi-classical gravity. So maybe if you have the stochasticity that you always have in standard decoherence, just think you have a background of gravitational waves or of dark matter particles, all kinds of things that we don't really understand. They are stochastically scattered. If you have the right mechanism that somehow gives you an increase in effects, that maybe that together with this non-linearity that you then get out of semi-classical gravity, that this can give you a consistent collapse model. So I'm kind of looking at everything from this perspective, and so I'm also looking at these hybrid models a bit from this perspective, and then see the similarities there, which is why I'm saying, okay, I would be interested in understanding in which way they are truly different. I mean, the model is relatively general, right? You have all these terms that you have to fix somehow, all these couplings that you need to determine. So it's the question: could it be that in the end some semi-classical theory could also describe effectively by an ensemble theory like that, right? If you would ask what would be a theory of ensembles of space-time plus quantum matter in semi-classical gravity, given some collapse mechanism, would you maybe end up with a similar theory? But I find this approach very interesting as well. And I would like to understand a bit more where the commonalities and where the differences are.
That's it. Thanks.
Any more questions? I think we've had many already, but it was very nice to have you. Very enjoyable talk. So thanks a lot, and everybody, we can thank again, André.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation again. And if there are any more questions coming up, you can just always write me an email and ask.
Okay, great. We'll have a good evening because it's already quite
late. Yeah, here it's actually late at night. So,
right.
I'm saying good night now.
Yeah, well, we will let you go. Okay. Okay. Bye. Okay,
thank you. Thank you very much.